Ladies. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Blanchard. I'll be your host this evening on behalf of the Board of Governors Professional Committee. Before we start, just a couple of housekeeping notes. One, please everybody turn off your cell phones now. It's really ruins the experience for everybody else if you get that loud buzzing right in the middle of everybody else's meals or everybody else's enjoyment of the movie. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about some of our upcoming events. Next Monday, lunch, we have Eddie Ng coming. He is the Education Secretary. This will be his first appearance here in one of his very few Q&A experiences before the media on his own without his colleagues, Ms. Lam and others. Since the Moral and National Education Fair of a couple of months ago. So we hope to see many of you there. That's this Monday, and we still have seats available for that, and so you're welcome to sign up for that on your way out. Next, we also have a dinner coming up, Steve Vines, and that'll be in 2 weeks, that'll be on the, in 2 weeks from now, and that is Food Gurus. I'll be talking about some famous recipes, and even we'll be serving some of those recipes. Our kitchen will be working extra hard that evening. And then finally, we also have Tony Wheeler, the founder of Lonely Planet. That event is sold out, but there is a waiting list if you want to add your names to it. With that one, I'd like to introduce our speaker for this evening. Many of you probably already know Mike Chinoy. He's a longtime former member. He was, of course, CNN's Beijing bureau chief. He has done much of the best work for now many years on North Korea going in and out. He is now, as you know, at the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California. He's been contacting many people, including some here, about gathering film material for this really very impressive series of documentaries on journalists who covered China over the years. I should mention that there's a constant challenge in an academic setting to raise money for these things. He does have to pay to get the rights, for example, to use some of the old footage from networks. And so the Institute does take donations after this event. For those of you who have missed some of the previous documentaries, which we've also shown here, he'll be selling them up here after the dinner and after his remarks at the close of the dinner. With that, Mike Chinoy.
Thanks very much, Keith. I'm delighted to be here. This is the third episode of this series, Simon China, that I've had the privilege of showing at the FCC. The other two, one was about the reporters who went to China with Richard Nixon in 1972. I showed that earlier this year. And before that, I showed one that tells the story of the first journalists who opened news bureaus for the American media after the U.S. and China established diplomatic relations. This is a series, for those of you who are not familiar with it, that we started with the premise that the way in which the American press has covered China over many decades has been responsible for shaping the way the American public and the American political class have understood or misunderstood China. Moreover, given the clout of news organizations like the New York Times, the television networks, the wire services, particularly in the pre-internet age, the way these American media organizations covered China had a disproportionate impact in shaping perceptions of China, not only in the States, but all over the world, because so many other countries relied on them as a principal source of news. And yet, one of the things I concluded in many years working as a foreign correspondent is that most people don't have the slightest idea how journalists actually do their job. But the way in which reporters cover the news has an enormous impact on the final product that you watch on TV or you read in the newspaper. And with a story as big as and as important as China, we thought there would be real value, in effect, in trying to tell the story of the people who have told the China story. Who were these people? How did they cover China? What were their dealings like with their editors? What were their dealings like with the Chinese authorities? How did they handle problems of language and cultural differences, of access, lack of access? How did you file? How did you make sense of a country this big and this complicated at different points in history? And so we started this project about 3.5 years ago, and it's now morphed into this giant monster. This is the fourth episode that we've completed. There are probably going to be five, maybe even six more that will take the story up to the present day. It begins with the story of the reporters who covered the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s, then goes through the 50s and 60s, the opening up, all the way up to today. When I showed the last episode, I said that I was working on one that looks at China watching in Hong Kong in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. Before Hong Kong became this great economic success story, this global trading center, its importance, apart from the just as a residence for the people who live here, but internationally, before that happened, one of the most valuable things about Hong Kong was that it became the key listening post to try and follow events in China at a time when China was largely closed off, certainly to the West and to Western journalists. And in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, this gave rise to a generation of reporters who became known as China watchers. And China watching was a kind of arcane set of skills that differed from going out in the field and reporting. And it posed all sorts of very complicated challenges. And it is the central theme of the film tonight. And the last time I said that I wanted to premiere this film here because it highlights an important part of Hong Kong's history, and I'm very glad to have a chance to do so. So I'll play the film. It's not quite an hour, and then would be happy to open it up for questions and discussion. I should say that the FCC does not figure in this film. It had its own film that the BBC did about 15 years ago. But I hope this will give you some sense of what it was like here and what the experience of trying to cover China from the outside during very difficult and challenging times was like. So with that, if we could turn the lights down, and hopefully the computer will work, and we'll get started. That's promising. Okay, great.
Minds are being replaced by this red book, the thoughts of Chairman Mao Zedong.
October 1, 1949, in Tiananmen Square, Mao Zedong declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China. No American journalists were there to cover the event. With the communist victory, the American press corps had been forced to leave China. The British colony of Hong Kong became the primary base for those who continued to follow the country, among them Roy Rowan of Life magazine.
We set up office in the Peninsula Hotel in the bridal suite. $300 a month, and we did the best we could.
John Roderick of the Associated Press, who, like Rowan, had spent the past several years in China, ended up in Hong Kong as well.
There in Hong Kong was a kind of curious breed of reporter called the China Watchers. Our job was to report on China from outside of China. In this case, Hong Kong.
It was very frustrating being a China Watcher because, one, you relied on other people's reporting. I had to do a lot of writing of stories based on all this secondary material, but I didn't find it very satisfying.
Soon after, in June 1950, the Korean War broke out. By the end of that year, the Chinese, who had intervened to prop up their North Korean allies against U.S. UN forces, were engaged in bloody combat with American troops. John Rich, who worked for the International News Service in China before the 1949 revolution, covered the Korean War for NBC News.
This is John Rich with an artillery battery north of Suwon, Korea.
Like many reporters, the experience profoundly influenced his attitude towards China.
Big effect, because we have an enemy there. We were chasing us down the Korean Peninsula, so a lot of hostile attitude.
Murray Fromson, who later became a correspondent in Asia for CBS, covered the Korean conflict for the U.S. military paper, Stars and Stripes.
American journalists bought into the Cold War psychology, and I don't deny it. I was one of those, like everybody else. We looked at China through Cold War eyes.
In the United States, the 50s was the era of McCarthyism, a witch hunt for suspected communist sympathizers, including those who allegedly had been responsible for the U.S. losing China to the communists. Seymour Topping had covered the Chinese Civil War for the Associated Press.
I thought it was absolutely unbelievable that there was such a debate. There was Chiang Kai-shek, essentially, and the Kuomintang Party that lost China. But nevertheless, it was exploited by McCarthy.
Rutherford Potes had covered both the final months of the nationalist regime in China and much of the Korean War for United Press International.
The McCarthy era certainly influenced all media in the sense that no one wanted to be accused by that right-wing fringe or by editors. As a journalist, as a press agency reporter, I had to feel that I had to show appreciation of the evil of China and of communism.
A number of veteran China reporters suffered during the McCarthy era. Some lost their jobs, others faced legal action. Washington's hostility to the Chinese communist regime was symbolized by the refusal of President Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, to shake the hand of Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai at a conference in Geneva in 1954. A year later, that attitude torpedoed a Chinese overture to the U.S. press made by Zhou himself.
Zhou Enlai then announced that American correspondents could return to Peking. I mean, great joy and excitement in the press corps all over the world in America. And we made plans to go back to China. In fact, AP named me, Frank Starzl, named me Chief of Bureau in Peking. And then John Foster Dulles intruded. He said, on no circumstances will you go to Peking. Will any of you go to Peking? If you do, $10,000 fine, 5 years in jail. That damped everything.
At that time, many reporters, including Theodore White, who covered China in the 40s for Time magazine, were sharply critical.
I think there's a fundamental folly, or worse than that, in the State Department's policy. In a way, they've accepted the underlying philosophy of the communists, that newspapermen are pawns or tools of government policy.
I traveled over 7,000 miles in this land which is larger than either the United States or Canada.
A very few reporters, however, defied the ban. Among them was Robert Cohen, freelance filmmaker. On a trip with a group of students to the Soviet Union in 1957, he and several of his traveling companions were given visas to visit China.
The mass media presentation of China is the evil empire. It's Fu Manchu. It's worse than Fu Manchu. You can't understand them. They're incomprehensible, inscrutable Orientals.
Cohen had been given a camera by NBC News and did a handful of short pieces, seeking to portray a country struggling to rebuild after years of war and revolution.
Basically, what I'm showing is a travelogue. This is what you would see if you were walking with me and had a camera.
Cohen and the others in his group were shown model farms and showcase factories, traditional Beijing opera, Shanghai cleansed of its former decadence. They were also granted an audience with Premier Zhou Enlai. But NBC's approach left Cohen disappointed.
What they showed on those shows were was the story, as NBC saw it, and that story was American use the five travel ban. It was not what is going on in China. The live industry and military, everything was going on in China was not being shown to the people of the United States.
After returning to the United States, Cohen was questioned by the FBI and harassed by the government.
My passport expired, and I applied for renewal. And I went, you know, sent it in with the... And renewal was refused.
It took a court case for Cohen to get his passport back. By the late 1950s, China entered a period of upheaval. First, the Great Leap Forward, Chairman Mao's push to transform China almost overnight into a modern economy, but which led instead to economic collapse and a disastrous famine. Then, in the mid-1960s, the Cultural Revolution. From listening posts like Hong Kong, a new generation of China watchers struggled to make sense of what was going on. Bernard Kalb covered Asia for the New York Times and CBS News in the 50s and 60s.
Chasing China is what we did. That was the obsession that we reporters had who lived in Hong Kong or throughout Southeast Asia. How do we get information about China? We got bits and pieces. We read everything we could. We put the mosaic of pieces together and try to extract some narrative about what was happening in China. But this was bits and pieces journalism.
Stanley Carno arrived in the British colony for Time magazine.
But I do remember vividly arriving in Hong Kong in May of 1959 with my wife and getting off the plane at Kai Tak Airport and, you know, immediately become thrilled and absorbed by the whole sort of smells and sights and so forth of Hong Kong.
Populated largely by refugees from Mao's revolution, described by some as a capitalist parasite on the skin of communist China, Hong Kong seethed with energy and intrigue. Richard Solomon was then a young American diplomat.
Hong Kong was a hot pot of foreign service people from many governments, journalist community, and academics. And basically we were doing all the same sort of thing. That is, trying to figure out what was going on into China.
Robert Elegant, a Chinese speaker who started with Newsweek and eventually moved to the Los Angeles Times, was among the more knowledgeable reporters.
Scholars, diplomats, spooks of various sorts and so on. And everybody knew who everybody was.
This was as close as reporters could get to the mainland, a hill overlooking the Chinese border. Here, they could peer across at rice paddies and villages, so near, but completely out of reach. American journalists tried every conceivable approach to get visas to China without success.
How to get a visa to China? That was our obsession. I was a young, barely literate New York Times reporter then, and I wanted to get as close to China as I could. The China I could chase was the Chinese ambassador to Indonesia, Wang Chen. He was a survivor of the Long March in China. He was a historic figure, a retired general who had gone into diplomacy. Then I would always try to see Ambassador Wang Chen in Indonesia at diplomatic functions sponsored by President Sukarno, at other events. I would sidle up to Wang Chen, and he would just as quickly sidle away from me. To say he was practicing for the Olympics would be to understate the spurt he took.
Barred from the country they were covering, the China watchers looked for other sources of information. One resource, the government-controlled Chinese media.
It was full of little men, or big men, some of them with radio sets, scribbling handwritten Chinese from the local broadcast, so that I'd walk into my office in the morning and I'd find a stack this high of handwritten Chinese. Well, obviously I wasn't going to get through the whole thing, but I got through enough of it to understand.
Robert Keatley arrived in 1964 for the Wall Street Journal.
Reading the People's Daily could drive you crazy because you kept trying to figure out, you know, where's the phrase that means something in all this drivel.
The reports coming out of Peking during all those years were stiff with sort of a verbiage and, you know, gobbledygook. But if you read it carefully, between the lines you discovered something important was happening in China. Some man was mentioned in third place instead of second place. He'd been demoted or executed or whatever. It was that sort of thing. It was kind of a detective work.
Henry Brancher was based in Hong Kong for the now defunct Washington Star.
a serious job of China watching, trying to understand what was going on, required going through that material every day. You're seeing what, not only what was being said, but what was not being said.
Many of the reporters came to rely on Father Laszlo Ladany, a Jesuit priest who had lived in China in the 1940s and then moved to Hong Kong.
The American correspondents in Hong Kong, for the most part, didn't speak Chinese. They relied on Father Laszlo Ladany, the Hungarian priest. He was the expert.
Nicholas Platt was a U.S. diplomat in Hong Kong in the 60s.
I think Ladany was the doyen of the China Watchers, and he was vastly respected. And his, you know, he put out a little publication every week, every 2 weeks, I can't remember, which matched in kind of intensity and depth the analysis of staffs that were 10, 15 times the size. Well, I remember calling on him in his office, which was a little bit bigger than this, and he had, you know, he'd pull a drawer out and there would be a tape recorder attached to a radio. He had all of his different radio stations all organized, and he was very systematic.
Father Ladany's great skill was his ability to read between the lines of Chinese propaganda.
Father Ladany, who was a great, great China watcher, a very good friend, used to say, you have to understand, if they say a bumper harvest, that means they almost met their target. If they said it was a satisfactory harvest, it means they only got halfway to their target.
Another key source was the continuing flow of refugees from China. Ted Koppel was ABC's Hong Kong correspondent in the late 60s.
The most accurate information that they were getting out of China tended to come from the waves of refugees who came out. And of course that began in the late 40s and went on into the 50s and even into the 60s.
I used to go to Macau. In Macau, you had hospices run by religious groups, and they would pick up refugees and take care of them, and they would let me interview the refugees. And I got a lot of good stories.
Relying on refugees, however, had its drawbacks.
That was not a main source. I mean, it was good for anecdote and quote and something. If it fit into something that really seemed to be going on, they could kind of describe what they saw around them, and that was very useful, but this was not a source of policy, explanation of policy.
As a correspondent for Time magazine, Stanley Carno had to contend with his boss, Time's publisher Henry Luce, an ardent anti-communist and supporter of Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang now ruled the island of Taiwan, while continuing to declare his intention to retake the communist-controlled mainland. Soon after Carno began his Hong Kong assignment, he accompanied Luce to meet Chiang Kai-shek in Taipei.
Chiang Kai-shek is his great hero. He put Chiang Kai-shek on the cover of Time magazine, numbers of times with Madame Zhang and so forth. We go there to Taiwan. We have an appointment to have dinner with Chiang Kai-shek the night we arrive. We go to the Grand Hotel, and the baggage has not arrived at the hotel. The reason, of course, is we flew in and we got off the airplane in Taipei. Some handlers came and took us in a limo and took us to the hotel, but we didn't know where the baggage was. So here's Luce, and he's fretting and pacing around, very nervous. He says to me, do you think they lost the baggage? To which I said, well, they lost the mainland, didn't they?
In the early 1960s, the pro-Taiwan lobby was still powerful in Washington. Henry Luce was a leading member.
And then after the dinner, we would have to go to a little side table, and there Madame Zhang would come. And here she was, all dressed up in her fancy changsam, with her jade necklace and so forth. And she spoke, you know, with a kind of southern drawl, you know, because she'd gone to a college in Georgia, Wesleyan College, you know, before she went to Wellesley. And she would nag Luce, you know, and there would be that kind of conversation where she'd say, Harry, we got to do something about the commies in Washington, that sort of stuff.
Soon after, Carnot left Time to become the Hong Kong correspondent for the Washington Post. The U.S. consulate in Hong Kong had emerged as a crucial center of China watching in the territory. By now, Seymour Topping was there for the New York Times.
The American consulate there, which is, you know, is was a larger mission than most American embassies abroad. They were interviewing refugees. They had managed to arrange for the smuggling out of provincial newspapers.
There were agents that were operating in China. There were people who were counting all the pigs who were imported into Hong Kong, and people who took photographs of, you know, railroad car serial numbers and a variety of other things. There was also satellite imagery of harvests and stuff like that.
Now, I, as a correspondent, had to a large extent access to that information.
The daily routine for reporters was like trying to find pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. Gerald Schechter arrived in Hong Kong in 1960 for Time magazine.
We really did to start out. I mean, you go to the consulate, talk to your buddies there, talk to foreign diplomats. The French were pretty good, the British were good. And then you try to get a peg. A couple of refugees would come over that you could maybe send one of the boys in the office to interview and put all that together.
There were often sharp differences of opinion among the journalists and the diplomats about what was happening.
The United States Consulate General in Hong Kong had differing views about what was going on in China, and some of the officials were feeding the press their particular perspectives on what was going on in China. Someone like Stanley Carnot would publish an article in the Washington Post, let's say, that would make one particular point or interpretation about what was going on in China. It would be read by senior State Department officials who would then say, hey, what's going on, or we haven't seen this particular point of view. So that our press, our media people, became a vehicle in part for this internal debate within the American government about what was in fact happening in China.
One of Carnot's best sources was CIA agent James Lilly, who in 1989 became the U.S. ambassador to China.
One time, Jim Lilly called me on the telephone. He says, listen, I got a story for you. And he tells me something over the phone. He's on Garden Road, and I'm on Kennedy Terrace. We're only about five steps away from each other. So he tells me something on the telephone. Obviously, he's trying to plant something with me. And this is the attitude of CIA. Now I'm working for the Washington Post. The President of the United States is going to pick up the Washington Post and read it at breakfast. If he sends it back through channels, it's like putting a message in a bottle and throwing it into the sea. If he leaks it to a reporter, the President's going to read it at breakfast the next morning. Okay. Now the reporter's got to be very careful. He doesn't want to end up being a conduit for the CIA guy. But on the other hand, he knows that the CIA guy's got a lot of information that's very valuable. So what happens is, over time, you develop a relationship with the CIA guy in Hong Kong or wherever you are.
The correspondents, diplomats, and spooks lived and breathed China.
Had a little group, known to my wife as a little boys club. We met every month. There were people from the consulates, various news organizations, and various intelligence organizations, and, you know, you kick things around and you compare notes and you put it together.
I knew them all. I mean, Elegant was very elegant and very grand in his presentation. Carnot was totally cozy, funny, made his points by asking questions. Bob Keeley was always very bland. His sort of bland appearance belied a very keen analytical mind, and he always had something smart, smart conclusion to draw. They were old friends. We did things together.
We were all part of like a family, sort of a China-watching family. The wives knew each other. The kids knew each other. You know, you went to the beach with everybody. You had dinners with everybody. My wife would go crazy. Can't you guys talk about something else besides China?
The Great Leap Forward, which Mao had launched in 1958 in a wildly unrealistic drive to turn China into a modern industrialized country in just 5 years, had been a disaster.
Mao knew nothing about economic, but they started to spiff up by sheer enthusiasm that they could raise China up and into the upper reaches of capitalism, as it were. And it failed. It failed miserably. And in 1960, countless millions of people died of starvation.
61, it began 59, 61. One of the worst famines with cannibalism.
Well, we have the bodies floating into Hong Kong after the Great Leap Forward.
But details still remain sketchy. The Chinese government, of course, said nothing. And at the time, reporters didn't really understand the enormous scale of the catastrophe.
I think if you look at the coverage, looking back on it, the numbers were so enormous, but we never had a grip on that. We knew it was a bad famine, in quotes, but it was hard to get quantitative, reliable information. We were saying there was a famine, but we didn't know the extent of it, and it was not possible to get a first-hand reporting. So I think what came out was a pale shadow of what was really happening.
In the early 60s, following the failure of the Great Leap, Chairman Mao had stepped back from active rule and allowed more pragmatic leaders, Liu Shaoqi, Zhou Enlai, and Deng Xiaoping, to guide China towards a modest recovery. But in 1965, the reporters detected signs that something big was beginning to happen. The opening salvos of the Cultural Revolution. Mao and his radical allies, including his wife Zhang Qing, aiming to topple the pragmatists and revive China's revolutionary spirit.
Mao, by 65, when it began, felt that he was being betrayed by his closest associates. And he started a movement which sought to destroy the government of the People's Government of China, sought to destroy the Communist Party of China, both of which were Mao's creations. He was turning on his own creations. And that's how it began, and it got worse and worse.
There's an article appeared in the Shanghai Liberation Daily, fiercely criticizing the opera Hai Wei resigns from office. Legendary story about an official who criticized the emperor and resigned from office. And all of the old Chinese translators, they said immediately, this is something big. And we have to watch this very, very carefully. It turned out to be something that Madame Mao and her people were aiming at, ultimately the Beijing provincial Beijing Party Committee. What was the opening shot?
About a man called, here comes a Chinese name, called Hai Rui, who was known as the upright mandarin, which is also a clue. But there weren't many upright mandarins. Corruption was institutionalized under the Confucian system as it is now. And it was somehow that thing began to ring bells. It was very odd, the reaction to this. And we saw that something very big was coming.
Soon, Mao mobilized his chief weapon, the youthful Red Guards.
So here's the Cultural Revolution that starts off, and the Red Guard papers start coming in. The consulate is translating the Red Guard papers, giving me copies of the translations. And the classified stuff was very good. A lot of the classified stuff was translations of the Red Guard papers.
In scouring the Chinese media, the clues came from many places.
I put Seymour Topping onto a story about the great Beijing Opera Festival on socialist subjects, in which the Pièce de Résistance was a one-act opera called The Bucket, in which the good guys and bad guys were struggling over, and the good guys being the women in the family and the bad guys being the man, struggling over a bucket full of night soil and trying to figure out whether it should be put on the private plot or be put on the collective. And this was considered, it was hilarious, although it was absolutely dead serious, and it was something that Madame Mao felt personally very strongly about.
With the Red Guards exhorted by Mao to destroy all old habits, customs, and ideas, there were other signs.
Suddenly, a little later, a great flood of antiques came into Hong Kong. The Red Guards, who the youth so-called, were actually supposed to be destroy the four old public slogans, destroy the four olds, the old civilization is bad, we must destroy the old civilization and on its rubble build a new civilization. These are all public. And the kids were doing this, but a lot of them were taking the little bits of the old civilization they thought were saleable and smuggling them out to Hong Kong where they were on sale. So, you know, this is another example of strange ways that one learned what was really happening.
As throngs of Red Guards paid homage to Mao in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, turmoil spread across the country.
There were things that were happening that couldn't happen if Mao had not lost control. There were battles between the so-called Red Guards, who were his so-called proteges, and people I called Red Sentinels. There were actually battles going on.
Sitting in Hong Kong, the reporters tried to piece together details of the factional fighting.
The translations of provincial papers and Red Guard papers and manifestos and, you know, lengthy descriptions of, you know, Group X attacking Group Y, etc. You know, who knew how true they were?
I did radio pieces in which I talked about the madness of the Cultural Revolution. Based on what I heard and what I saw, but if you ask me, could I prove what I wrote? No, no, I can only say it appears that. And that's apparently what we're saying, it appears that. Or according to informed sources, being the people in the embassy and the consulate general.
In a famous documentary in the mid-60s called China, The Roots of Madness, Theodore White spelled out the frustrations of the China watchers.
The American consulate in Hong Kong, there are cascades, mountains, piles of translations that come in from the Chinese. And these are sandy, gritty, gravel little bits of information that are meaningless because we don't know who does what to who in Peking. We don't know how they think or how they make up their mind, because no matter how hard we study China, we cannot predict such a thing as the Great Leap Forward in 1958. We can't predict such a thing as the Red Guard purge of 1966. It's as if there were a struggle of sea monsters going on deep, deep beneath the surface of our vision, and only these bubbles come to the surface to tell us that these are terrible struggles, but we don't know what they're struggling about.
Our attitudes during the 60s have been shaped by all the reporting about the Cultural Revolution and the turmoil, the Red Guard rampages, and there was a movie that Theodore White had produced called China, The Roots of Madness. And the basic point that he made was that this internal political struggle represented a kind of insanity or political madness on the part of the Chinese.
With Americans barred from China, Audrey Topping, the Canadian wife of New York Times Hong Kong correspondent Seymour Topping, somehow managed to get a tourist visa in the summer of 1966. A photographer, she arrived to find Beijing in chaos.
The Red Guards were all around, and opposite was the International Club. And I was standing on the fence taking pictures, and when I came down, the one Chinese student said, "I want your camera." And so this started coming towards me. And I said, "You're not getting my camera." I said, looking around and trying to be nice, and then across the street I heard a voice saying, "Audrey, Audrey." I turned, and there was Jacques Guillemot on the steps of the International Club. He was a French military attaché, and he said, "Run, run." and the students parted, he told me that this was a serious demonstration, hostile students, everybody is, we don't really, he didn't really know what's going on, but his read was get me out of there as soon as possible, and he got me tickets on the train. We get to Canton. And I think, they're going to get all my film. So they didn't, they just said, go. I got all my pictures and I did it. It was a cover story for the Times, yeah.
For American TV reporters in Hong Kong, covering the upheaval was virtually impossible.
Hong Kong is accustomed to this kind of propaganda from Red China.
We resorted to extraordinary means to get pictures. We would drive once a week out to the border in the New Territories. We would set up a large antenna. We would put a television camera, I mean a film camera, and shoot the output of a black and white television set which was hooked to the automobile battery, and we would pick up with the help of that big antenna, we'd pick up Guangdong television, and every once in a while you got some pretty good stuff.
With so little information, rumors ran wild.
Every once in a while I would get a phone call at 3 a.m, which of course was 2 p.m. back in New York, and some idiot on the desk had just seen a wire story quoting a Hong Kong newspaper, and there were some real crap papers, and these would always be the real crap papers which had reported that Mao had died. So the call would come saying, we have a wire service report that Mao is dead. And I say, it's 3 o'clock in the morning here. What do you think I'm going to do about that? Well, I don't know, but, you know, see if you can confirm it.
By the summer of 1967, the violence unleashed by the Cultural Revolution had led to virtual civil war. In the midst of it, Canadian Morley Safer, a correspondent for CBS News, pretended to be an amateur archaeologist and, like Audrey Topping the year before, got a Chinese tourist visa, along with a British CBS cameraman who said he was a travel agent.
700 million minds are being replaced by this red book, The Thoughts of Chairman Mao Zedong.
Chairman Mao is our great leader.
So off we went and spent the best part of the month during the Cultural Revolution, and it was quite honestly like Alice falling down the rabbit hole. It was just another world that we inhabited for those 4 weeks.
I would like to read that passage of Chairman Mao's quotations.
When we got off the plane, we were handed the red book, the Thoughts of Mao Zedong, and we stood in the airport reception area reciting the first couple of quotations together with this gentleman from the Tourist Bureau and a couple of his acolytes. And then we got on the minibus and we're taken to a hotel.
Safer found a country consumed by worship of Chairman Mao.
They sing, the ship cannot sail without a helmsman. We rely on the thought of Chairman Mao.
Despite the camera, the Chinese apparently did not realize that Safer and his colleague were journalists.
Johnny Peters, the cameraman, had a 16mm camera that was converted to look like an 8mm tourist camera, the sort of camera that any tourist back in those days of film would have. And it was also rigged for sound, so I was able to do one or two stand-ups as well while we were there when no one was looking, which was very difficult because there were always people looking.
It didn't take long for Safer to get into trouble. Visiting an agricultural museum, he observed that not all the farm machinery had been made in China, as the Red Guards were telling him.
Well, one of them overheard me. I was grabbed. I was arrested for insulting the people's machinery. Literally, that was the charge. We were both grabbed and frog marched
out of the museum, taken to a hotel lobby where a makeshift court was set up with a very, very angry young woman as judge sitting behind this desk. And she spoke English, actually. And she read the charge of insulting the people's ingenuity and the machinery. And I said, well, let me explain. And every time I said, let me explain, she said, shut up. And our guide, the man who met us at the airport, who was a lovely man, whispered in my ear and said, don't explain anything. Just apologize. Just apologize. And so she asked me some question again, and I said, I wish to apologize. And she said, let me hear your apology. And I said, reading it as I went, that as a victim of Western propaganda in the United States and their running dogs, I have been led to believe that the Chinese people were not up to this, that, or the other. And of course, my experience in China has just shown me the truth, and I want to apologize for these mistakes as a result of a bad education. Whereupon this angry young woman beamed like a Cheshire cat, and she said, that was beautiful. And the court broke up, tea was brought out, and everyone laughed, and we had a good time, and off we went.
Safer's documentary was virtually the only first-hand report on the Cultural Revolution to air on American television. CBS executives made no effort to control how he presented China, but even Safer couldn't avoid some of the political sensitivities of the time.
We decided to call this CBS reports Morley Safer's China Diary. And the day we were taping the studio parts of it, which was the day of the broadcast, Richard Surratt, who was the then president of CBS News, terrific guy, a decent man, great believer in the First Amendment, Dick said, we're going to change the title. And I said, why? What's up? What are we calling it? He said, you've got to call it Morley Safer's Red China Diary. And clearly, Dick had been told, perhaps, I don't know, or just fearful himself that if we did not call it Red China, we would be accused of being soft on Communist China. So it was called Morley Safer's Red China Diary.
Meanwhile, that same summer, in Hong Kong, pro-Beijing leftists, inspired by the Cultural Revolution, staged a series of violent demonstrations against British colonial rule. Marvin Farkas, an American freelance cameraman, found himself in the thick of the action.
At that time, leftists would go around every day, and they would march on the streets. They would march on Government House up that Garden Road. They would march on it, and they would cover the fences outside with derogatory things about the British. They would hang the governor in effigy and burn British flags. Things like, people were wondering, would the police department hold? You know, and they did. They were ripping off Mao badges and stepping on them, ripping up those little red books. And it seems, for some reason, all of these left, they all had eyeglasses. They were broken eyeglasses all over the street and blood, and they were sitting there, and of course, they had bandages already, wrapping bandages around their head and looking so forlorn, you know, pictures were fantastic.
As the Cultural Revolution continued, tensions between China and the Soviet Union, which Mao viewed as revisionist, having abandoned its revolutionary fervor, intensified.
This became very open, very hostile, shouting at each other, really. The Chinese publishing their version of what Marxism really said in this case. The Soviets sort of rocked back on their heels, really, by Chinese logic and trying to defend their position. And things went climb steadily downhill.
In 1969, armed clashes erupted along the Sino-Soviet border. For once, the Chinese made no attempt to hide what was going on.
These are the Hong Kong offices of Xinhua, the new China news agency. It is here that the Chinese version of the Sino-Soviet border dispute is passed out to the Western world.
When the Chinese were fighting the Soviets along the Yasui River, we would get combat footage that was coming off Chinese television, and then it was possible actually to do a story with video, which was a change for us.
The Sino-Soviet split was one of the catalysts in Richard Nixon's evolving view of China, one the former vice president, now out of office, had begun to spell out in private meetings with journalists. Wally Safer had lunch with Nixon in Hong Kong.
It was just an off-the-record lunch with Nixon, who was then sort of homeless in a certain way politically. And we were talking to him about China, rather, sorry, we were talking to him about Vietnam and the war, and Nixon just waved aside. He said, forget Vietnam, Vietnam is a sideshow. So the important player here is Asia, is China. And the most important thing we can do is recognize China. And the only person who will be able to achieve that is going to be a Republican president. So it was clearly on Nixon's mind long before he became a candidate.
Nixon also sought out Robert Elegant.
He wanted to know what the Chinese were like. He was told I knew about China, and he called me. Naturally, I went to see him. I was curious, so on the Mandarin Hotel, and I had a driver for him with a Volkswagen. And I told Wong, you know, come back in an hour. It was 4 hours. And I was very impressed, but Nixon was asking questions. I was trying most of the time, but this was a very penetrating mind.
The Sino-Soviet dispute and China's domestic weakness, even if self-inflicted, also led Mao to rethink his long-standing hostility to the U.S. In 1970, he invited Edgar Snow, the American journalist who'd first brought the Chinese communists to international attention in the 1930s, to join him in Tiananmen Square for Chinese National Day. A photograph featured prominently in the People's Daily, and in an interview, Mao told Snow Nixon would be welcome to visit China. Yao Wei was a young Chinese foreign ministry official who worked on the Snow visit.
The leadership took seriously about that interview, and they wanted every word to be exact. And Ed was supposed to give the magazine and the newspaper intact. Nothing should be changed. I was a little curious, you know, why and all the fuss. You know. And that was the interview. That when Mao said, welcoming Nixon to come with a message for us.
But the Nixon administration missed the signal. Winston Lord was then a young aide to Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger.
This was a very significant interview. And either lower level people in the government were aware of it and did not understand its significance and pass it up to the policymakers, or it was missed completely. We're still not quite sure why the White House was never really aware of this interview. But there's no question that Mao never did things casually, was sending signals.
It took the visit of the U.S. ping pong team in April 1971 for Beijing's intentions to become clearer. Soon after came invitations for Seymour Topping, Robert Keatley, and the publisher of the Long Island newspaper Newsday to visit China. The reporters were invited to dinner by Zhou Enlai, who used the occasion to signal a more flexible attitude on the contentious issue of Taiwan.
He, for the first time, delineated the policy of peaceful attraction of Taiwan, which still holds today. In other words, there was not an intention with military confrontation or invasion to take over Taiwan.
The whole point of it was just this minor symbol that there was something happening on the China-U.S. front.
In June, following a secret trip to Beijing by Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, the president announced plans to visit China. That fall, China was admitted to the United Nations, and Chiang Kai-shek's rival government in Taiwan was expelled. The move triggered a mad press scramble to talk to the Chinese diplomats coming to New York to take up the UN seat.
The trick was how to get to the Chinese delegation visiting the United States to go to the UN and be accepted in the UN. And I went up to New York and said, look, this is what I used to do when I lived in Asia. I would try to get on the same plane with foreign ministers or other officials and try to interview them on the plane when I could in no other way achieve any access to them. So what do you say we do this, CBS News? What do you say we do this? Tonight, Walter Cronkite, Gordon Manning, Vice President of CBS News, and I, and pick up a cameraman in Paris, go to Paris and try to find a way to be on the same plane with the Chinese delegation that has just left Beijing en route to the UN with a stop in Paris. We were able to dope out the fact when the delegation would be leaving, on which flight. We all, CBS bought us all first class tickets. 30 minutes after takeoff, I strolled down the aisle, did a small U-turn, and I looked down and I said, Mr. Foreign Minister, Mr. Ambassador, what a surprise to meet you here. And so when we got off the plane, CBS developed the film immediately, and CBS had this big exclusive at that particular point.
The main point, their extreme amiability in a situation where they might have been less than friendly. We had, after all, caught them unaware by being aboard with our cameras.
In China, however, Chairman Mao's decision to welcome Richard Nixon had generated sharp opposition, in particular from his designated heir, General Lin Biao. In September 1971, China watchers in Hong Kong detected clues that something serious was happening in the top leadership.
There was a big reception down in Hanoi for a visiting Chinese delegation. And at that reception, I guess it was around early 2021 or so, September. At that reception, the usual toasts were to Chairman Mao Zedong and his loyal deputy, Marshal Lin Biao. That was standard. About 3 days later, there was another reception in Hanoi for some other Chinese delegation. And at that reception, the toasts were to Chairman Mao Zedong, period. Well, boy, did I jump on this hard. Lin had suddenly been dropped from the leadership. It was very obvious, and I wrote that one really hard.
Soon came reports that Lin Biao had died in a plane crash after allegedly trying to overthrow Mao. Richard Solomon was by now an aide to Henry Kissinger.
One of the most informed reporters was Stanley Carno. You know, and he had his contacts in the intelligence community and in the diplomatic corps, and so he was getting enough information to be writing something that was fairly accurate about the internal leadership struggles.
When I wrote my story about Lin Biao, for example, in the Post, the Nixon administration, they went berserk. They thought that anything that was going to come out that the Chinese didn't like might cancel the trip.
Nixon and Kissinger really wanted to limit press coverage of China beyond official communication. What they were concerned about was that if negative stories appeared in the press about instability in China, then you would get questioning of, you know, how can we have this opening to China if they're tearing themselves apart with their internal conflicts. Henry was not happy when the Lin Biao business broke out.
But for most American reporters and their audiences, the internal politics in Beijing were much less important than the fact that with the Nixon visit, a country that had been almost inaccessible for more than two decades appeared ready to open its doors.
敬爱的毛主席，您是当代无产阶级最杰出的领袖、最伟大的天才，您和革命群众永远心连心，您是我们心中永远不落的红太阳。
that was fascinating, Mike, and Belize, and it really has been a terrific series. I've had a chance to talk to Mike at dinner here, so who would like to ask the first question now? Well, while you think of a question, I guess one of the impressive parts was just how much footage you had. And I know it was really a struggle for you because the networks aren't that cooperative on things like that. Where did you manage to get that much good footage?
It's like an archaeological dig. It's like an archaeological dig. You just scour everywhere you can. The networks have footage, but they charge a lot of money, so I'm also always looking for other resources. We got home movies from a number of different people, including folks who had lived in Hong Kong for a long time. For example, Stanley Carno and his family gave us their home movies from their time in Hong Kong in the 60s, which was great. We got some help from friends at CCTV. It took me 6 months to find a photograph of Father Ladani, the Jesuit priest, who I remember well from when I started my career as a fledgling China watcher in the mid-70s, and I remember him from that time. But it took me 6 months to find a still photograph. So it's just kind of an endless slog to... I had to go out to the University Services Center here in Hong Kong to get a copy of the Shanghai Wenhui Bao from November 1965 so I could take a picture of the famous article that the Yao Wenyuan, one of the Gang of Four, wrote about the high raid dismissed from office, which was the opening salvo of the Cultural Revolution. So, frankly, that's half the fun, is this sort of digging and trying to come up with stuff and scouring the archives, asking everybody I know, and then as you get this stuff, you sort of put the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together and try and create a kind of broader picture of what it was like at the time. I should say, by the way, that one of the people who's in this film is in this room, Marvin Farkas, who a very old and dear friend, who filmed the riots in 67 and many, many other things during a very long and distinguished career as a cameraman. So I'm delighted that he's here. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Hong Kong, of course, is still a China watching post for many of us, but now we can supplement that by going to Beijing. How do you think it's changed, and how does the role of watching China, you know, from Hong Kong now differ, or from Asia now differ from then?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, it's obviously changed profoundly in that China itself is a much, much more open society. There are must be almost 1,000 resident foreign correspondents, I think at least, or 800 resident foreign correspondents in China. The country is much more open. You can, as a resident foreign correspondent, get on a train or a plane or a bus and go to most places without permission. China, particularly with the internet and with Weibo, is a much more open society. You get many more insights. Information flashes around China much, much faster. It would be interesting to think about if you had Weibo in the middle of the Cultural Revolution, what people could have learned. And it's much, much easier to interact with Chinese people. It's easier to have Chinese friends. There are plenty of correspondents who, you know, have Chinese spouses or significant others. So there's a level of interaction with the society that was just completely impossible. There were a few Western journalists based in Beijing at this time. I think Reuters maintained a bureau, and actually its correspondent was kept under house arrest for 2 years at the height of the Cultural Revolution. AFP, I think, had a bureau, the Toronto Globe and Mail. There were a few, but there's an interesting sort of discussion about who did better if you go back and look at the coverage. And I would argue that the correspondents here did better because the correspondents in Beijing were quite literally trapped in their compounds. They really couldn't go anywhere. I mean, they could sort of look out their window and get a sense of the smell and so on, but they didn't have the refugees. They didn't have the intelligence agencies. And one of the things that struck me going over a lot of the coverage is how much of the story, the broad outlines of the story, the Hong Kong-based China Watchers got right. I mean, there were plenty of specific things they missed or got wrong, but the broad outlines, if you go back and look, it's pretty amazing. And part of that is that there were these kind of analytical tools for reading the press and so on. And one of the interesting questions now is, even though China is a vastly more open society, when you get to the very elite level, I don't think we have a clue what Xi Jinping actually personally thinks or believes about anything. We probably knew more about what Mao or Zhou Enlai thought and believed than we know about Xi Jinping. And so it's interesting how, for all the openness in certain areas, part of it remains very close, and so there was a certain amount of tea leaf reading and figuring out how the People's Daily play stuff that is still important. But of course, back then there was only the People's Daily. Now there is this huge range of what else is in the Chinese press and the internet, so you've got a ton more to work with. Yeah, Tim.
Mike, a couple of the correspondents said that it was a very frustrating job. Was this considered a plum posting, or was it a place where they sent people who was kind of a backwater?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was a pretty good posting. I think it's a lot of the correspondents who were here in the 60s didn't only do China. They did some of them more than others, but a lot of them did Vietnam as well. And I mean, someone like Stanley Carno or Koppel or Bernie Kemp would sort of be here, and then they would go off to Vietnam and they'd come back. So China wasn't the only thing they were doing. The foreign correspondents had a pretty nice life. I remember coming here in 1974, right out of college, and I looked up Joe Lelyveld, who was the New York Times guy here, who will feature in an episode I'm working on now, and he took me out on his boat in Repulse Bay on a Sunday afternoon, and he said, you know, if Chairman Mao dies on a Sunday afternoon, the American press is going to miss the story because we're all going to be on our junks. I don't think, you know, that would happen today. So I think it was considered a very good post, but it's a very tough assignment to try and piece all these, you know, it's like the proverbial thing that you're touching the side of an elephant trying to figure out what the whole shape and size of the animal is without being able to see it fall. Yeah.
It's striking that you have only one woman in the film who is the wife of Seymour Topping, so the wife of a correspondent. Although at Kuhn, there are quite a few interesting and creative, brave women correspondents in Vietnam. So I just wonder if it was perhaps the concentration of media in Vietnam that produced, you know, statistically a few women, and rather fewer were here.
I don't honestly know the answer. I mean, part of the limitation here is we are limited to generally people who are alive. There were, you know, the people here are sort of the most prominent China watchers. I'm not really aware of any. There were a number of very intrepid women war correspondents who kind of blazed the path. It was not commonly done then. But I'm not, you know, as I think about it, for the major media, I'm not sure that any women who are known as China correspondents in that period come to mind. If there were and they're around, I would gladly tell them. One of the great things about doing these projects is we put them on our website, and so if I get additional material, I can just add to it. I'm not limited in the way that you would be like a one-time showing on a TV network. Yes, anyone else? Yeah, Dan.
How about Claire Hollingsworth is a woman.
Sorry?
Claire
Hollingsworth, yeah. We're limiting this to American, people who work for the American media, partly because otherwise it would be too much, and partly because the Institute.
But in terms of this question, I think you should mention, I mean, if you ask about women, I think Clara Hollingsworth was...
She that's my voice,
not the mic.
She went to Beijing at the end of the Vietnam War in 75, so she was part of the first wave that opened bureaus. I think she was there...
She was
there
in 73.
She actually moved there from
But she worked for the Daily Telegraph, and we just made the British paper, and we just made a decision for manageability, and because I work for the U.S.-China Institute, that we're limiting it to people, not Americans, but people who work for the American media. And it's just, she's a very, obviously, remarkably interesting person in her own right. Mm-hmm.
Did you include John Burns as having worked for the Globe and Mail before he was hired by the Times?
Well,
that's sort of a funny category.
I just wrote to John Burns, and actually he hasn't replied, so maybe you could nudge him since he's your colleague.
Yes.
I want to talk to John Burns because he was in China in the 70s. The next episode that I'm working on covers from the end of Nixon's trip in 72 to the normalization of relations in 79, which is essentially the end of the Mao era. And John Burns is on my list both because he was there then, and then I'm going to do an episode on the 80s, and he was, of course, expelled in 1986. For trying to take a motorcycle trip across China, which is not something a correspondent would be expelled for today. So he's on the list. I haven't had a chance to talk to him.
What was the big thing that they got wrong? I have my own guess about that, but I want to hear you say.
I think there was a lot of coverage about were the Chinese going to intervene in Vietnam, You know, again, the limitations of time, and so I didn't really get into that, but I think that was the case where, you know, day in and day out, they charted, it's a bit like charting North Korean threats to turn Seoul into a sea of fire, day in and day out, but in fact, they didn't do it. The expectation that the chaos was going to lead to the collapse of the whole system. But in terms of just, you know, what was happening, the nature, you know, the power struggle, who was up, who was down, I think they got that stuff relatively right, given that they're operating essentially with one arm tied behind their back.
What were you going to suggest, Dan?
I would suggest the extent. I'm kind of jet lagged. I can barely speak. So bear with me, I'll get this out. The extent of the threat.
Yeah.
I actually was covering Vietnam, and I had to make a choice. Vietnam has come up a big story. The Christian Science Monitor, one guy covering Vietnam, based in Hong Kong, and I just said, I'm looking at this stuff, and it's going to take an incredible amount of work to do beyond what these guys were doing, which I respected, and I was almost afraid I would get it terribly wrong. And I was being told by people in Taiwan, there's this terrible famine. And I was being told by my maid, I was one of those guys who lived well on Concord Road, I had a maid and a cook, I'll never live like that again. Christian Science Monitor wouldn't even pay me to live in Hong Kong right now. And they were telling me, I think the maid was from Wuhan or somewhere, she says they're fighting in the streets. She would have been a hell of a good source.
Right.
You know, but I just had to decide, look, Vietnam is going badly. It's a big American story. I've got to be in Vietnam. So I came to Hong Kong, would kind of clean up a little bit. The phones worked and had a couple of good meals and then go back. And I just felt the numbers on the famine. I got to write a series for the Washington Post about the number of people who died on the Mao before the, I'm not claiming I broke some story or something, but somebody had an idea that asked me how many people died during all this stuff. Would you be willing to try to report? I said, I think I can do it. And I started getting documents. I came out with like 39 million people dying. I don't know what the latest thing is. Oh my gosh, we didn't know.
Jerry Schechter of Time Magazine says in one of the clips in here that we knew it was bad, but we had no sense. We had absolutely no sense that it was as bad. I mean, it's unimaginably bad. I mean, and even now, this book, Tombstone, which is now sort of the, it's just now come out in English. So, you know, decades later, we're still getting to
do you think the British media did a better job on that? Partly because they had people in there, and then also, I mean, the story is always told of Tony Lawrence noticing the number of people who were sending food by train from Hong Kong. And
I don't think people missed the famine, per se. I think that you know, it was a news story that things were bad in China, but nobody had the wherewithal to piece together just how bad it was. You had anecdotal stuff, things are bad, refugees, you know, people were swimming across. I remember the guy, the first editor I worked with at NBC News years ago, Larry Lau, had swum across in 1959 or something like that when he was a kid. So we knew stuff was bad, but somebody swimming out from here, could you translate that to Sichuan, to Hunan, to Anhui, how you put the numbers together? It would be interesting, actually, to go back and look at what Father Ladani wrote. And actually, one of the things I want to do, I think I've got the name of somebody who has all the stuff of the China news analysis has been digitized, and I'm hoping we can get that and put it on our website. By the way, this is not up on our website, but the three other films are, the website is china.usc.edu, and the three other films are up both in English and with Chinese subtitles. And this will be shortly. Any other questions?
Okay. One last question over here, and then we'll wrap up.
Thanks. Maybe two quick questions. Mike, how important were was the intelligence community? And I mean, you did speak a bit about it. But how accurate or important were they to the journalists? I think you were mainly speaking from the journalist point of view. And Keith, is that your father in the?
Yes.
Yeah, Keith didn't want to highlight that, but yes, that's Henry Bradshaw was one of the very distinguished China reporters, and I keep following his footsteps.
I have to
Yes.
Bradshaw, father. I was guessing he was the son. I was watching what Bradshaw was doing, and I thought, boy, how is he getting all this stuff? You know, I would have to be full-time, and I would have had to be full-time for what he did. I knew him. Actually, I owned some of the furniture from the family. He sold me a rattan couch that I still have in my study. It's a Bradshaw couch. And I actually should have said this earlier. I was guessing that's your father. I think the thing about him was he was totally persistent. This was his story. He didn't get diverted the way I was. I wrote a few, you know, pieces out of Hong Kong, which I would probably be embarrassing to look at now. But after Henry finished, he got some awards for his China, inside China coverage. I think if you examine what he wrote, it would turn out it would stand up very well. I mean,
he was the first in the West to identify the Gang of Four before they were publicly. Identified as such by the Chinese in the quarterly article. Yeah.
That comes in the next episode. Yep. I should say, for those who don't know, this is Dan Sutherland, who was Asia correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, covered Vietnam and Hong Kong, was a colleague of mine in Beijing, working for the Washington Post during Tiananmen Square, and now runs Radio Free Asia in Washington. I'm delighted he's here. Back to your question. It's hard to judge how right or wrong they were, but it was kind of the blind leading the blind. I mean, people were all looking at variants of the same material. The intelligence people obviously had more access to more certain kinds of things that spooks get, that journalists don't get, you know, intercepts, satellite imagery, debriefing. But part of this little episode that I have in the film, there were disagreements internally over lots of different things, and the politics of leaking was a very important thing back then, because you could get your analysis in the Washington Post and the president would read it, as Stan Carano said, which would give it some weight. And so people did this to push this or that pet theory or analysis. And that's part of how the game was played. Of course, the correspondents are just looking for information from everywhere. You took whatever you could, and then you tried to weigh up what resonated and made sense and was consistent with everything else. So it's, you know, it's different from rolling up your sleeves and plunging into a village and interviewing folks who are in the middle of something and looking around and seeing yourself and writing it. It's all, you know, at one step removed, and that created its own unique set of challenges.
And with that, thank you very much, Mike. That was fascinating. Before we let him go, though, two things. One,
you can get yourself in the room of the club by. You must have a wardrobe by now. You can fully outfit yourself.
Oh, great, thank you very
much. And then
much.
Second of all, he has some more copies of the DVD for those.
For those of you who are interested, this is a DVD of the film I did on the Nixon trip, which costs $200 Hong Kong. For those of you who are feeling generous for Christmas, we're always looking for tax-deductible contributions to keep this project and the USC-US-China Institute afloat. And I hope to come back in the spring with the next episode. I'd like to show all nine of them before too much time passes.
You're always welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you all.
Great. Let me get this.
Good change.